This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
John Loeffler here. Welcome back to the August recess version of Financial Sense News Hour. We'll be having Jim go on the record where we answer your emails. This is customary for us at the end of summer.
And John, keep our fingers crossed, because remember last year we had the China meltdown in the markets and we had to come back and do a special show. You know, one year we had Katrina and Rita. One year we had the financial crisis. I mean, I don't know. People have asked me to change our vacation times. Could we take time off at a different time of the year? We might have to consider that if we have another problem.
Well, it was really funny for Carol and me because we were in British Columbia when the market imploded, if you recall. So we were doing the shows, and at the very same time, forest fires were everywhere. So we're literally trying to do this radio show when we're choking on forest fire smoke, you know, that they were experiencing in BC and Alberta and the northwest part of the country last year. So it was one of those summers. It was almost a time off that never was. But here we go with today's Financial Sense News Hour. Number one, here we go. You have changed your position on gold this year after having been pretty negative on the metals for the last 3 to 4 years, recalling that in the first decade of the new century, there was a bull market in gold and in silver, which you accurately called back in 2001. But now you seem to be a little more sanguine on the metals again. So what caused the change off and back on again?
Actually, bribes.
Bribes. Does that work very well? At least until the Securities and Exchange Commission catches up with you, right? Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think when you saw a lot of the drivers of the gold bull market in the last decade, a lot of it was economic growth, especially coming from the emerging market. And that had a profound influence on the price of gold because all of a sudden you had billions of consumers that were coming into the gold market. And for countries like China and India, you know, gold is more prevalent as a form of investment in those countries than, let's say, financial assets as you see in the West, and especially in the U.S. The real key thing is I think gold, especially after QE2, which came in the fall of 2010, we saw a precipitous rise in metals. I mean, you had silver go from about $18, $19 an ounce. It went all the way up to $50. You saw gold go all the way up to $1,900. And it just got to be outright silly. And it was kind of like, okay, I'm paying a ridiculous price, but there's going to be another idiot behind me that's going to pay even more money. And especially as central banks were bringing in this quantitative easing, it was bringing down interest rates because, you know, what drives prices up? When there's a greater demand for something, it drives the price up. Think of stocks, think of real estate. When a lot of money comes into the bond market via central banks buying up sovereign bonds, they're buying up the bonds, they're driving down the interest rate. And, you know, we live in a world where the vast majority of investors, the large ones, are institutions. It's insurance companies that are trying to buy bonds to match liabilities. It's pension funds that are trying to earn a rate of return to provide for, let's say, retirement benefits to employees. And as yields were driven down, and especially as we got down into that 2% range, it just made stocks more attractive. And we were in a disinflationary environment where the actual real interest rates, that's the interest rate minus inflation, was positive. And so that was the environment that we lived in. And don't forget, after the financial crisis that lasted nearly 2 years, a lot of these blue chip stocks lost half their value. So you could buy good quality stocks. I don't care if you were looking at Dow stocks or you were looking at S&P 500 stocks, the PE ratios were much, much lower. And there was another trend that was taking place in the market, and that was the largest buyers of stocks were no longer investors. Investors had fled the stock market. They were in bond funds, or they were in precious metals, or they were in cash. Now you had corporations that literally were buying back trillions of dollars of their stock, and central banks, which were also doing the same thing. So you had strong drivers behind the move of the stock market. And we saw this between, let's say, 2012 and probably 2014, less so in 2015. I mean, it's the same thing that's driving up asset prices right now, is a lot of liquidity in the market. But I think the real key turning point came this past February when the Bank of Japan basically went to negative interest rates. We already had quantitative easing, and you had that in the ECB. But more importantly, that was also followed up by a change in the Fed's attitude. Now, remember, when we came into the new year, the Fed had just raised interest rates in December after talking about doing it for a whole year. And the thought was they would be raising interest rates every single quarter. And the Fed was very positive about where they thought economic growth was going to be. As it turned out, growth has been 40% of what their forecast is. And so the Fed started getting more dovish. And so the combination of not only negative interest rates, but also the Fed turning in terms of what it was going to do interest rate created that positive flood of money, because there were a lot of bets at the beginning of the year against assets, whether it was stocks, as stocks went down for 6 weeks in a row, commodities, which went down for 6 weeks in a row. About the only thing that was doing well were short-term bonds. And so I think that provided the catalyst, and I think that catalyst is still there and getting stronger, because I think the next move is, we just saw recently, one of the hawkish central banks, which was the Bank of England, basically has now turned dovish. And their Fed funds rate, or equivalent of the Fed funds rate, was at 0.5%. They've just reduced it to 0.25%. And so I think the same thing is going to happen with the Fed. So I think all of this bodes well for the final end game for gold, because when you have negative interest rates, it doesn't cost anything in terms of owning gold. In fact, you know, you take a look at negative interest rates, if you have your money in cash, it's actually costing you money. And that's why we saw this happen in Japan when the Bank of Japan reduced interest rates to a negative rate of return. Instead of spending money, they got just the opposite effect. People started hoarding cash. They went out and bought safes, and they went out and bought bullion. And I think that environment is the main reason why we have turn more bullish. And I think we are in another upward trend in the movement of gold.
All right, Jim, I've been listening to you for the last 4 to 5 years, and there has been a change this year. You're more bearish than you have been in the past. What has brought about this change?
You know, we follow economic indicators. We follow the LEIs. And one of the things that we began to notice is, first of all, corporate profits peaked in the summer of 2014. So that was something that was on our radar screen. Since then, you know, the LEIs would be almost back and forth. You would see them move into positive territory, then you'd see them move back into negative territory. There wasn't really a clear trend, and that pretty much reflected what we saw in 2015 and in the markets in 2015. But what we have noticed is a number of things that began to shift in the economy. And basically, we're watching what's going underneath the economy. It's no surprise, you know, the Fed is forecasting that we're going to have, what, 2.4% economic growth this year. We didn't even hit less than 1% in the first quarter. We're at 1.2% in the second quarter, and I see nothing that is going to get us even close to coming to hitting the Fed's target. So we've seen the economy, in terms of economic growth rate, it peaked in the second quarter of 2015. Corporate profits, as I mentioned, peaked in the second quarter of 2014. We've seen inventories decline 5 consecutive quarters in a row. We've seen the rate of job creation come down by roughly almost 50,000 jobs a month in 2016 versus 2015. We've also seen business investment contract 3 quarters in a row. And then we're also watching what's happening at the retail level. Retail sales have been weak. And more importantly, an indicator in terms of consumer spending, which is one of the main proponents that is holding up this economy, because 70% of the U.S. economy is consumption. And one of the first things that go when consumers start to pull back is restaurant spending. And so if you take a look at the last 6 months' sales of restaurants, 3 out of the last 6 months, and more recently, have been in a downward trend. So we're seeing a number of things: a peak in corporate profits, a peak in economic growth, a peak in business spending, 5 quarters of inventory liquidation, fewer job creation numbers each month. And remember, the numbers that even came out on the job front for the month of July, those are seasonally adjusted. We actually lost 1.2 million jobs in the month of July. Now, a lot of it is seasonal. It's, for example, teachers that are off for the summer and people that have recesses during the summer. So part of that can be explained. But the actual number was we lost over a million jobs last month in the employment survey, even though they're seasonally adjusted. And it showed that we added, what, 250,000 jobs. So when I see things that trend over a period of time, and it's not just one trend or one indicator. Our LEIs follow 19 separate indicators, and then we also follow indicators globally. We've seen a slowdown in global economic growth. We are seeing the growth of populism around the world and more anti-trade sentiments being reflected not only in the U.S., but also overseas. So there are a lot of negative things, but more importantly is we are now seeing things trend.
Yeah, but you know, Jim, we have an election coming up, and I would think that would change or had the potential for changing based on the outcome of the election and how the markets view what that's going to do for them.
Absolutely, it could, because both candidates, I don't care if you're looking at Trump or you're looking at Hillary Clinton, both are talking about massive spending. In other words, fiscal stimulus, and we'll get to that because helicopter drops is one of the questions that we've gotten a lot of emails on. That could change the outcome. I mean, if the new president, whoever that is, he or she, comes into office in January, and one of the first things they do is propose things that are very stimulative to the economy, such as tax cuts with Donald Trump or infrastructure spending from both candidates, obviously that would have an impact on the economy, and we might see economic growth pick up as a result. But right now, one of the reasons, you know, we go with what we follow, which are indicators. And when those indicators start trending negative, then we get more cautious.
Well, Jim, you've been a big proponent of dividend stocks, notably blue chip dividend paying stocks. But now, you know, it looks like the market's rolling down, probably in a recession by next year, and you have bearish views. Do you still recommend dividend-bearing stocks?
Absolutely. I mean, would I be 80, 90% invested in the stock market right now? Absolutely not. I mean, we own gold, we have cash positions, and we also have dividend-paying stocks. But when you take a look at interest rates, and they're likely to remain lower for much longer than anybody here thinks. I mean, you go back to the end of last year when the Fed raised interest rates, the consensus thinking on economic forecasts for this year is that rates would be rising. But here we are doing this interview, and we've got the 10-year Treasury note at a little over 1.5%. And so instead of going up, rates actually came down. And when I look around the globe, I mean, 2-year Treasury notes are at 0.7%. 2-year German notes are a negative 0.6%. So if you were to invest in a 2-year Treasury note in Germany, you would actually pay the German government. It's like that in various other countries as well. 2-year Italian notes are negative. You would pay the government 0.1%. If you take a look at Spanish government bond yields, they're negative 0.2%. If you look at the UK 2-year note, it's barely over 0.1%. I can go in blue chip stocks. I can still get utilities at 4%. I can get pipeline companies at 4 to 5. I can get staples in the 3 to 4% range. I can get even some technology stocks at 3%. So the nice thing about that is if you are in safe areas, we like things that people have to have rather than things that people want to have in terms of making investments. But where else are you going to survive? How are you going to get income? I mean, most of these blue chip dividend paying stocks, at least the ones we're looking at, are paying almost twice what you would get in a 10-year Treasury note. And remember, if you buy a 10-year Treasury note at 1.5%, if you own it for its entirety, the entire 10-year period, that's all you're going to get is 1.5%. If I buy a 3% dividend paying stock and that dividend is going up or 7 or 8% a year, in 10 years, instead of getting 3%, I'm going to be getting 6 and 7%. So they still have a place in a portfolio. And, you know, you don't want to put everything in dividend paying stocks. You do want to be diversified. We like short-term corporate bonds. But I still think in this kind of environment, where else are you going to get these kind of yields? Because, you know, what are we now? We're 8 years into 0% interest rates. We started with 0% interest rates. Now, 1/3 of all sovereign debt in the world is negative, meaning you pay the government to loan them money. So under these circumstances, I still like dividend paying stocks. And you got to understand, you're buying these stocks for a couple reasons. You're buying them because you're getting yield, so you're less dependent on the stock appreciation, or let's say the stock market going up, to get your rate of return. And more importantly, that yield is going to rise over the years as companies raise their dividends. And so I absolutely still recommend dividend paying stocks. But once again, I wouldn't put everything in the stock market right now.
Well, recently on the program, we were talking about the new abnormal. And given that things don't seem to be working with the central banks, which is the new normal, which is abnormal, what do you think happens next? This is a train that some people have said recently, some of your guests, we can't get off of this train now, and we have to play it out to the end. But how does it end?
Well, in the end, as one of my guests was Gary Shilling, in the end, it's going to end very badly. I think the next crisis is going to be worse than the one we just experienced and went through in 2007 and 2009. And you notice, John, that each crisis seems to be getting worse. We had a crisis in 1991 with the S&L crisis. S&Ls took in a lot of money. They made a lot of loans, bad loans. A lot of S&Ls went under. We had a crisis in the peso in 94. We had one in Asia in 97. We had one in 99 in Y2K. And then we had the bursting of the tech bubble. And then we had the financial crisis of 2007 and 2009. Now, if you look at the pattern that we've seen going forward and going back, looking back over the last couple decades, each crisis seems to get more pronounced and worse than the one that preceded it. So I think, what have we seen? We've seen central banks slash interest rates to zero. That wasn't enough. Then they resorted to quantitative easing, basically printing money. That wasn't enough. Now they've resorted to negative interest rates, and that does not seem to be working. I think it actually is causing a negative effect. It's hurting bank profit margins because, you know, the banks are having to pay a little bit more in interest, and they're not getting very much on their loan. Banks make money on the spread between what they pay you, the depositor, and what they charge you as a borrower, whether you're borrowing money to buy a car, lease a car, or, you know, let's say buy a house or even credit cards. So I think the next step is what you're going to see is helicopter drop. And helicopter drop is just a fancy word of saying the government deficit spends. They spend a lot more money, and then the Fed simply prints the money to pay for it. And that is going to be inflationary. And eventually, at some point in time, and remember, this is all a confidence game. You know, you have money at the bank. Now, think about this. The money you have at the bank, let's say you deposit, let's say $10. The bank is going to loan $9 of those dollars out in a loan somewhere. And they're going to keep $1 on deposit. In fact, there's various ways they can even get around that. Now, everything is based on a trust and confidence system. So if you put money in the bank, you have confidence and trust. If you have to pull your money out, let's say you need cash or you're going to go buy something, you have confidence in the system that the money's there. So it all works on a confidence system. When people lose confidence, as they did in the financial system in 2007, in 2009, money gets frozen. It becomes illiquid. And when you lose that confidence, that's when, for example, during the financial crisis, basically the Fed had to come in and backstop everything from commercial paper to the money market funds to loans to the balance sheet of our major investment banks and global banks around the globe. At some point in time, the markets are going to figure that out. And the place to look for a clue when we're getting to the end game will not be the stock market, it'll be the bond market. And bond market will begin to demand higher interest rates. Now, when that happens, there's no way that the government is going to be able to pay its debt. They're going to have to either devalue the currency and rid itself of the large debt, because the problem that you have right now on the globe is governments are accumulating debt at a much faster pace than economic growth. And we know in the long run, what that means is you will see a devaluation of the currency. And basically, central banks, if you're an investor, they've sent you a message. They're going to do everything they can to debase the currency, and eventually they'll be forced to devalue it. So we're in a process. It's just like a topping process in the market. We're in a process that is unfolding to the next crisis with central banks. Now, they can keep this extended for much further than any of you or I could expect. And it may well go on for an extended period of time before we reach the end game. But I think we're at a pivot point right now, and the next pivot point is going to be a shift more towards an inflationary environment than a deflationary environment, which is what we find ourselves in now. And I think that's what maybe the rise in commodities that we've seen since probably the lows of February are signaling to the markets.
Jim, you know, we've done a number of interviews about health, especially on lifetime income and the role of diet and taking care of your health. What have you found to work with since you've tried both vegetarian and paleo diets? And, you know, a lot of these diets, they'll work for people like for 10 pounds. They lose 10 pounds and then they plateau out. Nothing happens after that. A lot of people are frustrated, but being at the right weight is important. It affects blood pressure. It affects diabetes. It affects a lot of other things, you know, hypertension, etc.
I've tried a number of diets over the years, everything from the Mediterranean diet. And more recently, I went on a vegetarian diet. There's a food company here in Southern California that prepares vegan meals, and they deliver them fresh to you every week. And I tried vegetarian, tried it for a couple of months. I did not like it. Number one, I gained weight, which is not what I wanted to do. Number two, I work out with weights 5 days a week. And, you know, on upper body days, I do at least an hour worth of weightlifting. And I don't know about you, John, when I get out of the gym, I want protein. My body wants something that's heavier. So I tried the vegetarian diet. It did not satisfy me. I gained weight on the diet, which is not what I wanted to do because I'm trying to lose even more. I've lost, 20 pounds over the years, and I'm trying to lose another 10. And I found the paleo diet is more satisfying, where you eat lean protein. You know, I eat things like turkey, a lot of seafood like salmon, and also things like lean chicken. And if I do have beef, I maybe have it maybe once a week. It's grass-fed beef. And then I have that where 3/4 of my plate, I guess the difference between the way I eat today, I would say maybe 10 years ago, half my plate was protein, beef. I ate a lot of beef and then a lot of carbs. The carbs that I have today, I would say 2/3 of my plate is vegetables, everything from a fresh salad to steamed vegetables, and then lean protein. And I found the paleo is what works with me. John, you tried vegetarian for a while. How did it work for you? It didn't work for me. I gained weight.
We did too. We were on vegetarian diets for 2 or 3 years, and we actually gained weight instead of losing it, which really surprised me, you know, given a lot of the touting that goes on for vegetarian. We've had more success on diets that are similar to a combination of paleo and a couple of other things.
Yeah, I found when I get out of the gym after my workouts, you know, I crave a nice filling meal, and I just did not get that with the vegetarian diet.
That's when you run to the Mexican restaurant and gorge out on burritos and tacos. And is that how you diet?
Yeah, I was doing things like, you know, nachos and, you know, doing all kinds of things. And I found myself snacking all the time. And a lot of the snacks I had were like plant-based energy bars. And I did the whole thing, but I ended up actually gaining weight. And for some reason, you know, I have heard, and we've interviewed people on this, that people have different blood types do much better on certain diets. So we all respond to the food we eat much differently. But, you know, I take a look at the Asian diet. You go to Japan, they eat a lot of seafood and a lot of vegetables. You see that in Asian diets or even diets in, let's say, India. So, you know, everybody's a little bit different, but I found paleo is more, you know, my body handles that diet much, much better. But everybody is a little different. And I just find it just wasn't filling. And that was the problem. I ended up snacking more. And I think it was probably the snacks that put on the weight. But the reason I was snacking is because I was hungry.
Yeah. And Jim, I think this is important. See, I went to my doctor about 5 years ago. And I said to him, he said, well, you know, your body mass index is a little high. And I said, okay, here's the deal, doc. We're on a pretty good relationship. And I said, you're looking at a dude who has ridden 50,000 miles on his bicycle. I've swum until I become a fish or drown and been on every diet on the planet. And I said, I'll make you a deal. I'll go on any diet you put me on. There's only one thing you have to do. You have to guarantee me that it's going to work. And he got real quiet. And I said, okay, shut up. Don't you ever bring it up again in a physical. Okay. Because I said, you medical guys, you're great at telling me I need to lose weight, but none of you can tell me how. And that's the important thing, you know. So finding the diet that works for you, because it does it. You know, I find, Jim, as I lose the weight, my blood pressure goes down. As a matter of fact, I would have to get off of blood pressure medicine as my weight went down, because my blood pressure would drop too low at that point. And it affects, of course, hypertension, cardiovascular disease, and diabetes. And that's actually what I told him. I said, you'd think your profession had this one nailed. And frankly, I think the alternative people have a better idea about how to lose weight than some in the medical profession.
Did you find, though, when you went on those diets, let's say vegetarian, it changed your blood chemistry?
I never noticed that too much. I'm trying to think of how it affected, you know, the blood panel. But that was a long time ago. I can't remember. We just remember we gained a lot of weight on it, both my wife and I.
Yeah. See, I gained about 5 or 6 pounds. But, you know, I was only vegetarian for about 6 weeks. And it was really hard to stay on it because I was constantly, constantly snacking. And then I found myself going to the health food store, you know, Whole Foods. I'm talking to the people, you know, what's a healthy snack? So I was eating everything from nuts and basically energy bars that were plant-based and doing all those things to kind of fill in, because I was thinking, well, what my body is wanting after a workout is protein. So I was eating a lot of these protein bars, but John, it just didn't work. And I found under the paleo, I lost weight, but improved my blood chemistry as well.
And that's theoretically what it should do. Okay, well, here we are in the middle of silly season. I should say it this way. Here we are in the middle of silly season. We have two stellar candidates, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and magnate Donald Trump. I keep thinking to myself, is this the best we can do in this country for president? But anyway, having said all of that, would you tell us who you think would be the presidential candidate you would vote for? Or can you actually do that?
You know, we did a show. What was it? About 2 or 3 weeks ago, John, we did a show. It was right after the Republican convention. We took the platforms from both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. Now, both parties want to stimulate the economy. The difference is there's two different approaches here. One is sort of socialistic in the sense that you raise taxes and just redistribute the wealth. The other one is more market-oriented, where you lower taxes and create incentives. And I prefer market-oriented solutions. I just don't think redistribution and taxation works. I mean, if it did, you would see Venezuela and other countries like that prospering. Instead, you have just the reverse. The problem with redistribution is if I give you a check from the government to stimulate the economy, I give you that check, and it's hoped that if I give you that check, you're going to go out and spend it. Okay, so when you get that check and you spend it in the economy, it stimulates the economy. But here's the problem. After I give you that check and you spent it, now what do? I have to keep giving you checks. Versus, let's say, if I can create incentives in the marketplace, let's say I create tax incentives for people to invest. So a company goes out and builds a new plant or orders new equipment. Well, what does that do? It creates jobs, because you're buying equipment. Somebody had to manufacture and make that equipment. And that's, you know, the difference between the two different platforms. There's two different ways to stimulate the economy. One is through socialistic policies, which I believe don't work. And the other one is more free market oriented. The only thing I would probably, I guess, disagree with the Trump camp is protectionism. And he accuses China of being a currency manipulator, but China has tied its currency to the US dollar. So when the dollar rose over the last year and a half, as the dollar rose, so did the Chinese yuan. And so that impacted China as well as it did our U.S. manufacturers here, because the dollar became more expensive. So our exports went down because our exports became more expensive for other countries to buy. Same thing with China's exports. So that's probably the one thing I disagree with the Trump campaign, is this anti-globalist protectionist measures, because I don't think anybody benefits from that. We all benefit as consumers. If you and I can buy goods in a store that are cheaper because of different manufacturers are supplying a good to you, and you could buy it at a lower price, we all benefit from that. So, you know, I prefer more free market solutions to stimulating the economy. Although I agree with both of them that, you know, we need to have some kind of infrastructure program, because the infrastructure in this country, I think the Society of Engineers is graded U.S. infrastructure is kind of like a D minus. Yeah, I mean, I don't care if it's bridges, roads, our airports, our utility structures, everything in this country is aging. And a lot of this stuff, John, as you know, was built during the Eisenhower years and during the Great Depression, whether it was the Hoover Dam, a lot of this stuff was put in place 60, 70, 80 years ago, and it is aging and needs to be rebuilt. So I think that would be a positive thing. And that's one thing I like that is in both platforms that are similar to both. And secondly, I think one of the things that I am really concerned about is the geopolitical risks that are out there. As we discussed in my interview with Michael Lewitt, these are dangerous times that we live in. We have a war against us with Islamic terrorism. You have Russia, you have China. The world has become a more dangerous place. And so I would prefer a stronger defense in free market solutions than I would, let's say, socialism or to downsize our U.S. military. I think that's a very fatal mistake that we're making right now, very similar to what England did under Chamberlain in the 30s while Hitler was rising in power in Germany.
Well, just as a reminder for everybody of what we're doing this week and next week, the end of August, beginning of September, we always take a 2-week recess here on the program, and we've prepared a show where this week we did On the Record. Jim will be on the record next week. What's coming up as far as guests or anything else next week, Jim?
Coming up next week, I do a full-on one-hour interview with A. Gary Schilling. We did an interview a couple months ago, and unfortunately, Gary was outside. Gary raises bees, and he was outside on his cell phone, and it was just poor reception. So I'm going to redo that interview, update it, along with his current thoughts on where interest rates are going on, thoughts on political candidates, thoughts on what's going to happen to the bond market, helicopter drops, and also some very prescient calls that Gary has made. He still thinks the Fed will not raise interest rates, and also thinks that we could see 10-year Treasury notes hit 1%. That will be coming up next week, along with the continuation of the second half of On the Record. All that coming up next week. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries, or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.